This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
My name is Daniel Roth. I'm a faculty member here at Pardes, and I direct our Center for Judaism and Conflict Resolution, which integrates intense text study with contemporary conflict resolution theories and practices. And this evening's lecture is sponsored in memory of Brando Pomerantz by Huti and Jay Pomerantz, and we thank them very much for sponsoring this evening. And as part of our center, we run a bunch of different programs in Israel and in North America, and one of our programs is for synagogues and rabbis, which is run by my colleague, Rabbi Amy Alberg, and it is a great honor to have Rabbi Amy in Israel for the summer, all the way from the faraway land of Palo Alto. So I welcome her, and we're going to be splitting the shiur between us.
Great. He has more, a lot more to say than that, so just so you know. And I'm up for a little while, and then you'll hear him. So the honor is really, really mine to be teaching at Pardes and to be teaching and learning and working with Daniel Roth, who is the real thing, scholar, practitioner of conflict resolution. It's really, really great privilege to get to work and learn with him. So Daniel honored me in a way. There are a lot of different ways we could have entitled this shiur. Daniel honored me by using a framing in the title that comes from a text that we'll study in a minute, but a text, an ancient Jewish text that I love so much that I named my book after it. So if you look at the first text, we're going to jump right in, very first text on your sheet is a verse from the Avot Rabbi, a section from the Avot Rabbi Natan, essentially a midrash on the better known version of the dialogue in Pirkei Avot, which among other questions is asked the question, Ezehu Gibor, who is a hero, who is mighty, and the Mishnah pushes against the immediate intuitive answer, which is to say, you know, someone is strong, powerful, brave, physical prowess, runs into a fiery building to rescue someone. Those are unquestionably acts of gvura. But to go deeper than the intuitive response, the Mishnah responds with one who hakovesh et yitzo, person who conquers her inner inclination. Gvura, heroism, according to that Mishnah, is an inside job, not a matter of external characteristics. The Avot Rabbi Natan quotes that question and that answer and then says, in good rabbinic fashion, v'yesh amrim, there's another answer to the question, misha ose son o ohavo. Who is the mightiest of all? It reframes the question. Ezo gibosh giborim. Who is the mightiest of all? The person who makes an enemy into a friend. I love this text for many, many reasons. Partly because walking around my own community and the world saying that my work these days is around conflict resolution, and not everyone appreciates that. Not everyone respects that. A lot of people kind of want to literally or figuratively pat me on the head and say, oh, how nice. How nice. You think about the end of conflict. Have you read the newspaper recently? This text rightly names an act of peacemaking, whether it's interpersonal peacemaking between us and one other person, or on macro levels, into the highest kind of heroism. This is work that takes strength and courage and determination and the focus and self-awareness and clarity of priorities that forces us, in order, if we are to succeed, to push against inclinations that are literally hardwired into us for evolutionary reasons, right? We're hardwired to fight back against an enemy, and so should it be as a human race. And in some ways, so is the case for the Jewish people. If we, absent that instinct, we wouldn't be here, quite literally. And yet there are times when the highest response is to transcend that initial response, is that someone is my enemy, someone is, hates me, I should respond aggressively. This text that we have dated, let's say, 6th century, but it may have its origins earlier in the Beit Midrash, says there are times that the highest kind of behavior is to overcome that very deeply wired instinct and to reach for a different place inside ourselves and for a different kind of response. Our question tonight is to explore what is the wisdom here when the texts talk about the enemy and about the potential for reconciliation with the enemy or with the hated one, and to explore how and when this applies in relationships, both interpersonal, communal, and even sometimes international, though that won't be our particular focus. The point of this evening is not to persuade you that unilateral outreach to an enemy is the right response in every situation. It is definitively not the right response to an active shooter situation. It is not the right response when someone is climbing through one's, God forbid, child's window with a weapon. It is not the answer to ISIS. Okay? Our claim is not to say that this is the only behavior that we should master or aspire to. The question is, when does this apply? Given that this wisdom is articulated in the tradition, it's our job as students of the tradition to discern when is this the right response. For what kinds of situations are we to emulate this kind of behavior and aspire to it? Again, my point, this is the headline, what I'm gonna explore, but if you were to remember one thing that I'm gonna say, I think it would be, we often dismiss this way of thinking, enemy to friend, don't be ridiculous, naive, how could it be? You don't really understand, they're really terrible. For very good reasons, evolutionary, emotional, all kinds of reasons, we tend to dismiss the possibility of transforming enemy into friend, because it's difficult, because it's scary, because it's dangerous. The question that I want to explore tonight is for what kinds of situations is the Torah pushing us to push against our own self-defensive instincts, or even just to push outside the realm of the comfortable and the intuitive. Someone is mean to me, I instinctively want to be mean back. It's natural. When and how and why does the Torah ask us to reach beyond what's natural? And to put it even more strongly, the text that the Avot, the Mishnah Avot version of the text that says, the act of heroism is to conquer our own evil inclination, that is to say, evil inclination within, is to suggest, and maybe this will sound radical, is that sometimes our conviction that there is nothing that can be done regarding a particular enemy, and for this sentence I'd ask you to think of an interpersonal enemy, the instinct within us that says that particular enemy is incorrigible and impossible and there's no possibility of shifting the conflict at all, sometimes the voice that says those words in our heads is the Yetzer Hara talking, is not our best selves. Our question, the question we explore tonight and all of our collective and individual questions is, when is that the reason to be applied? Next text I'm going to go right through. Text number 2 on your sheet. Maybe you can ask and I'll decide whether I answer or not.
read that Misho says Sono Ohavo, it does sound like it's could be a one way. Because if I take a person that I hate and I start to love that person.
Correct. That's a possibility.
An enemy really is a difference than somebody who I hate. I can hate for jealousy reasons.
It's a possibility, and we're going to look at a couple of examples where that's the case, where it's a unilateral situation. Rav Chaim of Volozhin, text number 2, says, when you think about the text in Psalm 34, remember, Bakesh Shalom Verodfehu, seek peace and pursue it. The words, Bakesh Shalom, seek peace, mean that you should want there to be peace between you and that other person, even if, in your opinion, he or she sinned against you. Even if you know they sinned against you, even in the occasion of a real betrayal and a real hurt. Nevertheless, Reb Chaim says, the verse in the Psalm says, you should want peace even with someone who has hurt you. Nevertheless, pursue it, even though really what arises in you naturally is, why should I want peace? They hurt me. That's impossible. Let him reach out a hand of peace. That's what's going to naturally arise within you. Nevertheless, Rodfehu, pursue it. You should be the Rodef Shalom, says Rav Chaim, the pursuer of peace, and not hope or wait for your fellow to reconcile to you first. So I ask you just for a moment, if we had more time, if this were a day-long workshop, I would ask you to take out a journal, sit in Chavruta, but for now, just a moment of personal reflection. I've been talking now for a couple of minutes, probably for everyone in the room. Someone individually or collectively has come to mind. So I'd ask you, there's a little bit of blank space on the back of the sheet. If it's helpful to you, I'm going to stop talking, really. Unbelieve it or not, for just a minute, to give you a chance to think and maybe jot down a couple of notes. And I would ask you if you can think of both an interpersonal situation, an individual person that came to mind as I was talking, and if you'd like, some kind of collective situation, because these texts can be read on either or both levels. So I would ask you, who comes to mind, and what feelings have arisen in you from listening to me so far and from listening to the Avot of Rabbi Natan and Rav Chaim? What was stirred in you? A minute of silence. And how countercultural it is to ask a group of Jews to sit in silence for 60 seconds. I'm going to resist the temptation to either ask you to share those with one another or to share them with all of us. I'm going to resist that temptation. That was to you. The point was, note it. Please keep those situations in mind. This is not, what we're doing tonight is not an academic exercise. Please keep both of those situations, if you have both an interpersonal example and a collective example, keep those in mind. That's precisely what we're talking about. And to the extent that some or many or most of you had some feelings of resistance arise as I was talking, or maybe especially in response to the text, something in you tightened and said, what are they talking about? That's ridiculous. How could that possibly? Why should I? I thought that's not a Jewish response. Whatever. Whatever resistance may have arisen in you, don't push it away. That's the point of this text. These texts are a response to the reality of those feelings. These texts are saying those feelings will arise in you. How are we going to respond to them? Are they going to be in the driver's seat, or is there a higher road? So please keep that in mind throughout. That said, let's go on to what we might say is the classical locus of exploration in the Torah about the case of the enemy. There are probably a couple of texts that might qualify for that, but the enemy slash hated one, which, as far as I can tell, are used interchangeably in some places. So, looking at text number 3, somebody, wonder, should we read it out both in Hebrew or in English? Just English? People can read along in Hebrew. Would somebody read it in English, please? Big voice.
When you encounter your enemy in cough or in donkey, wondering, you must take it back to him. When you see your enemy, you sag under his blood and you refrain from raising it. Even though it's tape, you must raise it with it.
Great. Daniel, who did the final editing of the handout, gave us this fabulous image of a laden down donkey. I said I've lived the past 12 years in St. Paul, Minnesota. So when I teach this text at home, I always use an example that there ought to be right next to this an image of a car stuck in a snowbank. I know that joke doesn't really work here, but when I say tell in Minnesota, everybody knows exactly. Are you going to stop or are you not going to stop?
Right.
And everybody is paralyzed. Everybody is paralyzed. So maybe it works better in Minnesota, because in Minnesota there is a culture of a lot of people know what to do, and everybody knows that the decent thing is to help. Nonetheless, if you see who it is at the back of the, behind the wheel, or it's the person that you just had that terrible thing with, are you going to stop? Or are you going to say, let the next person help? Right? And that's a contemporary. I have to think of a warm weather, contemporary application as well. Couple of comments about the verse. What do you notice about the verse, these two verses? What questions do you have about it? Yes, please. Please. It would take a week or two to really do justice to that question, and peace to that question. Wonderful. You know what? Let's hear some questions, and I'm not going to even try to answer them. What questions do you have about these texts?
Is this aimed at your enemy, or is it really kindness to the animal?
Great. Wonderful. Is this about the person? Is this about the donkey driver, or is this about the animal, or both? Other questions? I see.
Your aim is to turn the, I will say, the person you don't like, and that will cover both. Into a friend.
Why? Why is it necessary to turn that person? Why is it desirable to turn that person into a friend? Wouldn't it be better? Or what about the option of just avoiding? And I heard in your kind of struggling with the language, what I heard, whether or not this is what you intended, is some discomfort with the language of enemy and hate. Like, what is this? Torah talking about an enemy and hatred, and what is that exactly? Other questions? I'm sure there's more. But, okay, maybe that's what you've got for the moment. So, I'd like to spend a few minutes exploring the question, who is this enemy? What is the Torah talking about? Like, you know, our Torah is a Torah of Chesed, right? We have all these midrashim about how, you know, the Torah is a Torah of Chesed from start to finish. What is this enemy stuff? Who is this enemy? Or who is this hated one? Why is the Torah sort of encouraging us or reifying this notion of enemy? Like, it's okay. It's encouraging us to populate that category. Who is the enemy? So if you look down at the very bottom of page 1, under the heading, Whom May We Consider an Enemy? Text number 4 is from Leviticus 19:17. Interesting, it's the immediate neighbor of the universally known verse, 19:18, Ve'ahavta le'recha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. Not quite as well-known verse, 19:17, Lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha, do not hate, literally translated, your brother. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Big, big question, who is your brother? Most of the commentaries would say, I think, is that right? Most of the commentaries would say, this is a fellow Jew. So the Torah says right there in Leviticus 19, you can't hate another Jew. You're not allowed to hate another Jew. So the hated person or the enemy person in our text number 3 must not be a Jew, right? That's a possibility. Yes.
You have another place in the Seven which was built on a premise of preceding a marriage. For instance, if you're commanded to return an object, so
correct.
Dealing with self-delivery.
Correct. That raises for me the question, why does the Torah even have to say this? Isn't it pshita? Why is the, if you see the animal, you have to help return it or you have to help, I mean, of course you do. By one would think that from those other places where such a thing is said, one could infer. But I understand that you were going in a slightly different direction. That's a great question that I'm not going to do justice to. Okay? Hold on to that. So if you turn over the page, text number 5, in the Mechilta, this is an early rabbinic source. This is not the whole of it, but this is 3 sticks of it in which different rabbis are trying to figure out, so who is this enemy? One, Rabbi Yoshea says, this must be a non-Jew, maybe because of what I said before. I mean, you're not allowed to hate a Jew. So it's only conceivable that when the Torah says enemy, that it means a non-Jew. Next view, Rabbi Yitzchak says, when the Torah says enemy, it must mean a Jew who left Judaism, Yisrael Mishumad. Okay, maybe, whatever. There's lots more. We're not going to exhaust all these possibilities. Third view that I've listed here, Rabbi Natan says this refers to a Jew, but what's the implication of the phrase, your enemy? It says enemy. It refers to a situation in which someone becomes your enemy lisha'a, temporarily, as a result of striking your child or picking a quarrel with you. According to Rabbi Natan, you can allow someone in your life to fall into the enemy category or even into the hated category. If they hurt your child, for example, something terrible happened, you may hate them, as it were, temporarily, but not more than that. That's Rabbi Natan's view. And onward to what somebody read, text number 6, the Rambam.
The enemy mentioned in the Torah is a Jew, not from the nations of the world. One might ask, how is it possible for one Jew to hate another? Is it not written in Leviticus, do not hate your brother in your heart? Our sages, Talmud Bavli, Pesachim 113b, explain that this refers to a person who sees another violating a transgression and offers rebuke, but the author does not repent. In such a case, it is a mitzvah to hate the person until he repents and abandons his wickedness.
Okay. So the Rambam summarizes the logic that I've articulated so far in a way. He says, as opposed to the other possibilities in the text above, he starts with, we're talking about a Jew, despite the fact that you'll immediately say, what do you mean? How can a Jew be an enemy? It says, lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha. So he says, yes, it's a Jew. And in response to your question, well, why, how could it ever be okay to hate another Jew? The sages, he quotes, the Talmud Bavli that says, if you see another Jew, committing a transgression, and you offer rebuke. Some of you here, we spent 2.5 hours today in class just beginning to crack open the whole concept of tochacha or rebuke or a difficult conversation in the Jewish tradition. So if you see, closing that parenthesis, if you see another person committing a sin And you've actually told him, you've actually called it to his attention, said, you know, this is really a sin, you really shouldn't be doing this in some form. And the other did not do tshuva. The other didn't repent, despite the fact that they knew what they were doing. In such a case, it is a mitzvah to hate the person until he repents and abandons his wickedness. Anybody uncomfortable with what I just read? I am, yes. But it's there. I used to arrange not to put text like this onto my handout, but I think Daniel has convinced me otherwise. Part of the tradition for the sake of honesty and for the sake of the practice of Redifat Shalom, which is all about expanding our consciousness, our mind and heart, to understand and, if possible, empathize with multiple positions way beyond our own. So I don't like this position personally. It's in the tradition. The end of the Rambam then continues, and it's cut off in the text, is despite the fact that this is a person that you're allowed to hate because they're a sinner, excuse the harsh language, but that's the language that he's using, despite the fact that you may hate him, or even you must hate him, mitzvah, right, to hate him, still, if you encounter his, her, you know, donkey having fallen and the, you know, the stuff is the groceries are all over the road. The animal is one thing, but here it seems like we're talking about the person, despite the fact that you don't have to push the feelings of hate away from your heart. Still, you should help. Still, you should resist the temptation. The temptation is going to arise in you. Let someone else help, or he deserves it, or whatever else might arise. Still, despite the fact that you may be holding hate in your heart about him, it's your obligation based on our verses in text number 3 to help. Please.
I would have liked to have seen an example that didn't have to do with an animal.
Correct, except that there's a lot of the commentaries, or it seems like most of the commentaries don't place this in the context of Tzar Balei Chaim, but they're really, really talking about the human relationship. On first glance, it looks like it's about the animal, but that's not necessarily where the commentators go. Is there a question over here? Yeah, David.
If that's the case, though, if you're helping this person even though it's a mitzvah to hate him, aren't you kind of doubly violating the line of Leviticus? Not only are you keeping hate in your heart, but you're keeping it in your heart.
So we need to go back and study the Gemara in Pesachim and follow that through to see how do they deal with that. Okay, we're not going to have time to do that. Great question. Not going to have time to do that tonight. So keep that in mind. There's a view that you can hate someone because of their evil deeds, right? You could hate another Jew because of their evil deeds. Text number 7, the Meshech Chochma, early 20th century Orthodox figure, says, it seems that your enemy here in Psachim, and we saw it in the Rambam, refers to one's enemy because of his deeds, although, as we're all saying, it's forbidden to hate one's friend in one's heart. If one saw him transgressing and not doing tshuva, it's permitted to hate him. But if one sees another sinning, one must first examine one's own deeds and find one's own flaws and obstacles before hating the other. First, you have to look at your own flaws and obstacles. And when you finish with that inventory, then you're allowed to hate another person because of his deeds. How long is that going to take? Right. Only one who has himself or herself departed from evil and is a perfect tzaddik, b'chol drachav, in all of life, such a person may hate a sinner. But he says, I kid you not, this is a direct translation, it is difficult to find such a person. So when I first encountered this text, I thought it was a joke, right? If you're a perfect tzaddik, you're allowed to hate. Huh? There aren't very many perfect tzaddikim around. But if you found such a person, that person would be forbidden to hate. This is a sense of humor, right? Or actually, a perfect tzaddik, if there were such a person, that person, and only that person, might be able to separate between really hating the deeds without really condemning the deeds without hating the person. So maybe it's a joke, maybe it's not a joke. Onward. And then the next couple of sources, which I'm going to go through really fast and probably without questions just because of time, explore the question, why? As I don't know your name in the front row, I think Ricky asked, why try to make an enemy into a friend? That's the question I look at. And these three sources, again, not a comprehensive collection. Why should we reach out to an enemy? I'm going to read these myself so I can interrupt myself. Text number 8 from Midrash Tehillim, Rabbi Alexandri says, so a person goes out to the road, sees his fellow's donkey collapsing under its burden. He goes and gives him a hand, helps him load it up, unload it. They go into an inn. And then the donkey owner says to himself, oh, I thought this guy hated me. He just, like, got all schwitzy and, you know, spent a couple of hours helping me, and it was really dirty, you know, lousy, difficult work. He must love me. Immediately, they begin to speak with one another, and peace comes between them. What caused this peace and reconciliation? The fact that he, the passerby, who chose to stop, despite the fact that he might have said, let him stew. What caused the peace and reconciliation? The fact that he observed what is written in the Torah. If you see the donkey of your hated one lying under the burden, he observed the mitzvah of unilateral outreach to the enemy on the road. And that's why it says, Derachecha darchei noam v'chol nativota ha-shalom. The Torah is a Torah of kindness. If you follow this mitzvah, it's gonna lead to kindness. It's gonna lead to peace. So answer to the question, why should we reach out to the enemy? Answer number one in text number 8 is, it may bring about reconciliation. Text number 9, another piece of Rambam in Hilchot Deot. You shall blot any offenses against you out of your mind and not bear a grudge. For relating to another part of that same verse that says, lo tikom velo titor, don't do vengeance, don't bear a grudge. For as long as one nurses a grievance and keeps it in mind, one may come to take vengeance. He's working with another piece of our verse in Leviticus 19. The Torah therefore emphatically warns us not to bear a grudge so that the impression of the wrong shall be completely obliterated and no longer remembered. What? What is the Rambam asking us? How is this possible? Is this Jewish? You should wipe out the memory of the bad things that were done to you so that it's completely obliterated and no longer remembered. This is strong language. Very interesting. This is the right principle, he says. It alone makes civilized life and social interaction possible. The Rambam's answer to the question, why should we reach out unilaterally to an enemy, is that the civil workings of society depend on it. Civil society. Oy, it's hard to even say that term, right? Or shall I just say functional society is impossible without this kind of instinct of generosity, going against the first impulse of he hurt me, she hurt me, let them stew, right? Society requires this kind of behavior. Answer number 3 to the question, why should we reach out to an enemy, in text number 10, Targum Onkelos. Oh, you know what? I'm not even going to take the time. It's a sort of a pun in the Aramaic, in his Aramaic understanding of the verse. He reads the verse to say, the verse actually says you should let go of the impulse in you that says, don't help the donkey driver. You should let go of the impulse to refrain from helping. Targum says, what you should let go of is the hatred in your heart. So answer number 3, represented here by the Targum Onkelos, to the question, why should we reach out to an enemy, is, I would say, it's good for your soul. It's spiritual practice, and the Torah demands it of us. Not because there isn't a lot more to talk about, but just to sum up for a moment, I come back to where I began. It's clear that this mitzvah, this overlapping set of mitzvot, does not apply to all situations. It does not apply when you're in mortal danger. I think it does not apply when there's danger of significant abuse. But it does apply when it's uncomfortable to fulfill it. It does apply in situations of discomfort. It doesn't say only help your enemy if it initially feels good to do so. And I suggest maybe speaking only for myself, but I think other people that I know as well, the Torah is saying, you need to do this more often than you feel like it. So it does, this mitzvah does appear, does apply when there may have been a misunderstanding. And even if you are sure that you understand why the person did this terrible thing to you, actually, maybe your understanding is incorrect or incomplete. So if there may have been some understanding, that's a time to think about this, this set of mitzvot. If you've been nursing your anger for your own reasons, because it feels good, because it makes you feel strong, because feeling angry at this person, you hear I'm emphasizing the interpersonal, because feeling angry at this person makes you feel better about some other hurt that was perpetrated against you really in your life by someone else. If you're nursing the anger against this person for your own reasons and not even considering there may be actually more to the situation on the other person's side than I know, I'm not really interested in listening to him in that kind of situation, the Torah says you need to do differently. The mitzvah does challenge us, does ask us to push past the emotional tendency to turn away, to blame, to demonize, to instinctively attack the one who has hurt us. The question for our lives is, what's in between the situations where this obviously does not apply and the situations where it obviously does apply? What about all of most of life? Right? Those in-between situations. What about the collective situations? Huge question, which I'm going to turn it over to Daniel. He's going to answer all those questions. That's our question. How to discern what's in the center? What's the right response? What's the mitzvah response? What's the elevated, Jewishly elevated response? Notice that this, I love these texts because they fly in the face of a certain narrative that is, in my experience, prominent among our people, that says, let them do their own tshuva. I'm just going to wait here in my hard-hearted state. That's not what anybody says. That's my judgment. I'm just going to wait here until they do their tshuva. I have absolutely no, there's no requirement on me to do anything different with my feelings. I'm just going to keep nursing my anger until they come to me and do tshuva. There's some basis for that attitude in the text, but there's also some basis in the text for something different than that. It's very hard work. Is it easy? No. Is it Jewish to think in these terms? Unquestionably. It requires a lot of introspection, a lot of self-awareness, a lot of discipline, a lot of humility and hopefulness and ultimately courage as we started. And finally, I love this text. And so when I wrote my book on Judaism and conflict resolution, I wrote the book. Some people are smart enough to get a publisher first and then write the book. I took the risky road of writing the book and then looking for a publisher. And so I had in my head, the title's got to be From Enemy to Friend, despite the fact that I know people who've written books. I know that actually the publisher gets to decide what to call the book, but I really thought the publisher can decide about the subtitle. Really, really, it has to be From Enemy to Friend. I think because that phrase for me captures the potential and the power of this practice. And that phrase captures the way in which when it's impossible to act in this way, when reconciliation is unquestionably not possible now, that phrase, from enemy to friend, for me serves as a prayer for the time when something more may be possible than is possible right now. That's it for now. I'm turning it over to Daniel and more later. I'm out of my time, but maybe later.
So Amy spoke a lot about the example of helping with the donkey. I want to bring up a couple of other case studies that come up in Jewish texts, and through that, engage in some of the complexity as well. But because you mentioned that certain cases, it's totally off limits, I want to start with just touching upon a text that I actually did not bring for you. I apologize. If people really want it, I'm happy to make a photocopy and share it. But one that really shakes me up, we talked about helping with a donkey, not much risk. But there's a pasuk in Mishlei in Proverbs that says, "Im ra'ev sonecha, hechleu lechem, v'im tzameh, hashkeu mayim." That if your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat, and if he's thirsty, give him water to drink. And here, the Midrash on that Pasuk says, Midrash in Psalms, if your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat. Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina said, even if he rises up to kill you, and he comes hungry and thirsty to your house, feed him and give him drink, and God will make peace between you. I don't know if how many of you followed the news. I think, was it now 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, that there was a terrible pigua, a stabbing in, was it a stabbing or a shooting? It was a shooting, I apologize, in Tel Aviv. And a policeman and his wife accidentally hosted the terrorists in their home and gave him food and water to drink, not knowing who he was. They took the verse slightly literally, okay? A little bit too literally, but it really pushes. It's one thing talking about a donkey. It really pushes to say, oh my God, an enemy that actually comes, rises up to kill you. Every Israeli is brought up with haba lehogecha, someone who rises, comes to kill you, hashkem lehogo, kill them first. Here the language in Hebrew is, even though he woke up to kill you, you feed and you feed them and you give them water. It's a crazy risky idea. So there are Jewish texts that push us even in those more fringe areas. You know, is it really a threat as they show up at that very moment? Or is it that they're now weakened? It leaves the text leaves it for us to use our best judgment. But there are examples of that also in Islamic texts. There are hadiths in their oral tradition of Imam Ali, who turned enemies to friends by offering food and water when the enemy that was attacking him ran out of water, and he actually had them transfer over which side they were actually fighting for by doing that act of kindness. But you got to be really smart, otherwise you're about to get yourself in danger and get yourself killed. But one other one that I'll just quickly share that goes even more radical than that in terms of who the enemy, that it tells that in the Babylonian Talmud, it asks, why did Esther, in the story of Purim, why did she invite Haman and Ahasuerus to the first banquet, just to ask them to go to the second banquet? It's perplexing. It's strange. Why have that whole banquet the first night? And one of the opinions says something pretty crazy. It says, what did Esther see to invite Haman to the banquet? Rabbi Oshia said she learned this from her father's house. As it says, if your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat. And if he's thirsty, give him water to drink, and God will make peace between you. It's actually suggesting, the Talmud, that Esther was reaching out to the ultimate enemy of enemies, Haman. There you go. You gotta be on your guard, right? Even Haman, to try applying this logic, could there have been a possibility of shifting his attitude? So those are radical cases. It's so radical that when I mentioned that source in my doctorate, and I worked very hard to prove that that was the correct reading, one of the readers says, you must have read that wrong. That's not Jewish. I said, I'm telling you, I check the manuscripts. That's what it says. But I want to do a slightly more, one more case that comes up in Halakha. And that is on page, well, that's part two. It says, visiting and comforting an enemy. Okay? I don't know where the page number is. A question came in the mail sometime in the early 14th century to one of the greatest German scholars of the time, known as the Maharil, Rabbi Yaakov ben Moshe Molan. And all the question said, as he opened up his mailbox, was, someone who hates their fellow person, is he or she obligated to visit them when they're sick, or permitted to do so, or perhaps it's forbidden, since it will look like you are rejoicing in their time of calamity? That's it. You have no possibility of saying, can you please clarify the question, because it probably took 6 months for that letter to get in the mail in the 14th century. The guy might have died by then, right? Exactly. They may have already made friends and came and fought again, right? But that's how rabbinic literature would evolve. They had a case. So I'd wanted to have you think this through a little bit in Chavruta, but I want to be sensitive to the time. We want to end in about 15 minutes or so. But just unpack the question, right? Thinking about if you have ever been in situations like this, whether it be in a shiva, you know, you heard of somebody passed away, you haven't really been in touch, maybe you had a falling out. Do you go? Do you not go? Would you want, if God forbid you're sitting shiva, would you want somebody to show up? Maybe not. Or the alternative scenario that they're offering in the question is somebody's really ill. You know, you heard of somebody in the hospital, not doing well. Do you go and visit them or not go and visit them? Are you obligated? Is it permitted? Or perhaps it's forbidden to do so. So before we invite into the room five rabbis that argued this over the last 600 years, we'll take a few comments. If you had to write a response, what would you say? Take a moment, and then let me know. Yeah, Adam.
So the question is, one who hates his chaviro, his kind of fellow. It's not. It doesn't talk about your oyev. It doesn't talk about your enemy. It doesn't talk about. It talks about something. It's almost like, you know what? These guys in my circle, I never like to be close. It kind of feels like that as opposed to my enemy. And, right. If it's somebody like who I'm supposed to be friends with, but I just because my wife likes his wife, I have to like him. The guy's a jerk.
Can you be more specific about who you have in mind? Are they here this evening?
So it doesn't feel like we're talking about enemy.
So if you were writing your rabbinic response out, you would say, listen, it's going to depend on what kind of enemy you're referring to.
I would say somebody in your social circle or somebody in your pet, in your then I think you absolutely have to go visit that person.
But where would you draw the line?
I would say if it's a person that is your enemy, then
be more specific.
If somebody is known that publicly you have a conflict and it's a dispute that the two of you don't talk to each other. If it's somebody who had that relationship with them, then you're not required to go.
But you'd let them.
I would let them go.
Okay, but you wouldn't obligate them. Let's take some other responses.
Yeah. I think it's largely dependent on kind of the demeanor and the tone of the person visiting. Because you can come into the room with the tone of, look, you know, I know you're very ill, this is our chance to reconcile, it's important, etc. I don't think it's just a question of appearing silently or not appearing silently. I think what is said and how you connect to the person or their family while you're there is also important here.
So it's dependent on the person.
On your own intentions of why you want to come.
Mm-hmm. So you would write back in your letter saying, check your intentions. What's driving you right now? Why are you doing this? Other responses.
Yeah. I would say you won't have to check going off of that who it's really benefiting by you going.
Mm-hmm.
If it's just personally benefiting you and you know that he or she truly hates you and they're going to be angry and it might harm their condition even more, if it's really only about you at that point, then it's probably best not to go. So sort of seeing who will actually benefit from the situation.
Right. I mean, it could be really good for you and your personal tshuva list that you can say, well, I reconcile with that guy, but do they want you there? What about their needs? They're in a vulnerable situation. So you would add in, don't forget to think about how is this going to impact the person that is your on the other side of this. Any other responses? Thoughts? Yeah?
I think I would actually follow that up and try to say, you need to go. Don't enter the room. Peek your head in and say, I want to wish you well. May I come in? Like, I would...
Proceed with caution.
But...
Err on the side of going, but don't just all of a sudden show up and say, I haven't seen you for 30 years since that huge fall, and, you know, expect they're going to really want to, you know, embrace you and that moment of vulnerability. Any other responses? Before we invite some rabbis? Rabbis in? Yeah.
I'm wondering how the Shema before bedtime works out, because
every night everybody is forgiving anybody who did anything mean to them the entire day before. So technically, you know, it'd be wonderful if we were even at this point, because everybody has prayed for God's forgiveness for anybody who has harmed them.
You bring up a beautiful, important text and important point, which is that every night before one goes to sleep, we do something not so different than what you do, lo aleinu, on a deathbed or before Yom Kippur, which is you do a unilateral forgiveness of anyone that might have harmed me intentionally, unintentionally, physically, emotionally, whatever it is, sort of a blanket forgiveness. But I think that there's an important distinction in Jewish law and in psychology and in conflict resolution studies between unilateral forgiveness and bilateral forgiveness. Unilateral forgiveness we're encouraged to do all the time. As Amy was talking about, working on our own hatred, working on our own evil inclination. That doesn't necessarily mean I've reconciled and we've forgiven each other in the bilateral relationship. It's often perceived in Jewish law as a prerequisite. I have to first do the work on my own, and that might enable for there to be an encounter between the two. But it's a great point. So I want to invite it.
Did you want to add?
I was just going to add, like, in a litmus test, you could also be reflective and say, well, if I were in that situation,
mm-hmm.
how would I feel? Although it's impossible to be in someone else's situation, but to really kind of do a check in on yourself, how would I feel in that situation?
Yeah, if we would have more time, and this would be part of a regular Pardes class, 2.5 hours, it's amazing how I'll ask people to think of the text of their lives. You know, a story that happened to them, a story that happened to their parents or to a relative or somebody in the community. And what I'll often find is that people will pull out one text, a narrative of somebody showed up and it was totally superficial and it ended up actually creating, you know, in a very uncomfortable situation that they felt like they had to do this act of reconciliation when they really emotionally didn't want to be dealing with that at all. And then somebody else will bring up a story of it was the most healing moment of the Shiva. And they'll each be talking from within their own intertext, their text that fills in the blank of this story. And the answer is, well, there's a whole bunch of different experiences. You know, it could go this way, it could go that way. As we've been talking about, you have to really think carefully. So I want to invite in,
Rebecca, did you want to add?
Just very quickly, two sexist type of questions. When we talk about hate, we're talking about hate constantly, but I keep thinking of it as negativity. And I'm wondering if part of the reason for trying to get rid of that hate is the problem of holding on to negativity. I think like a machad chabad point of view, bring light where there's darkness, bring light.
Right.
In a sense, what is that? Is there something intrinsic about the negativity of hate that in itself is a problem for us in the world?
And therefore, we want to encourage to overcome it. So you really helped a segue into the response of the Maharil. If you look in source number 2. So this is what the Maharil himself wrote back. He said, if the person is amongst those who it is forbidden to hate. Here he's already alluding to what we just studied with Rabbi Amy, that there are a category in Jewish law of those who are you required to hate. In which case, you don't go. Okay? And with all the problematics of that. However, the human evil inclination forced him to hate him. The opposite is the case. It is even more of a mitzvah to visit him than other people, as it is proven in the Talmud. If a friend requires unloading and an enemy loading, one's first obligation is towards his enemy in order to subdue his evil inclination. In other words, you need to work on yourself, says the Maharil. What's holding you back from visiting that person is your hatred. Some falling out that you had. This is an opportunity for you to do a tikkun, for you to do some work on your inner midot, on your inner self. Overcome what's your natural inclination, your yetzer hara, your evil inclination, or your natural inclination to not want to go. And dafka, go out of your way to do that. Sometimes we're always wondering, do I want to go to the Shiva? Do I not want to? It's far away. And I haven't really been in touch. We even had a falling out. Dafka, you should go, says the Maharil, because it's difficult. And here they bring in another important primary text from the Talmud about if you have two people in front of you, one an enemy and one a friend, you help the enemy, even if his need is less than your friend. Of course, be careful with that text because you might not have a friend. Okay, so you have to be careful when you border cross into trying to reach out to an enemy. Do you still have your own citizenship to hang out with your friends? It's a very important balance, but similar to what we were talking about, overcome your hatred is the first response. But then, about 100 years later, Rav Moshe Isserles, author of the Shulchan Aruch for the Ashkenazim, the Rama, pushes back against the Maharal and he says, wait a minute. There are some who hold that one's enemy can go and visit the sick who hates him, meaning the Maharal. And it seems to me, rather he should not go and visit him, and he should not comfort him when he is in mourning, for he is his enemy. So that the sick person does not think him, the visitor, is rejoicing in his tragedy, and it only causes him suffering. This is what it seems to me. Talking about, right, you're so interested in being altruistic and overcoming your inclination, that's great, but they don't want to see you right now. I watched the other day with my younger children the new movie Dory. Okay, if you haven't seen it, I recommend it. But those of you, the first one is called Finding Nemo, where there's a wonderful scene of sharks trying to overcome their evil inclination of wanting to eat fish. So they have to bring a fish friend to their support group, which is great for them. But the fish who have to go to the support group of the sharks are terrified. I think that's what the Rama is saying. He's saying it's wonderful you want to have your support group to overcome your evil inclination, but not on their cheshbon, not on account of the guy who's sick or who's in mourning. Think about them, and therefore I'm going to tell you, says the Rama from within the text, better not to go. It really could be perceived as a type of a ruse, a type of patronizing, you know, you're showing up, you're in a place of strength, you're in a position of health, you're doing great, and they're doing lousy, and you're showing up to your old business foe or whatever it is, and you're doing it, and they're in this terrible situation, they don't want to see you. And then it takes another 100 years until somebody tried to reconcile between these two opposing views, the Shach, Rav Shavtai Cohen, where he says, however, everything is according to what the hatred is over and according to the enemies. Can we just identify the fact that this is all ambiguous? And therefore, the halacha is use common sense. Because I'm not going to tell you what to do from within the text. You're going to have to use your own sechel at that particular moment to think about what's the nature of the enemy, what's the nature of the conflict, and is this going to be a helpful thing or is this going to be a counterproductive thing? So I'm not going to tell you what to do, but that didn't end the conversation. Turn the page. 200 years later, comes the Aruch HaShulchan, and he says, I have an idea. Let's not just leave it up to you. We still want to encourage people to actually reconcile. And therefore, he wrote the following. And so, if the enemy sends to the sick person beforehand, expressing that he would like to visit him and to comfort him, after a loved one passed away, and he gives him permission, he is allowed. And all the more so, by this peace is made between them. Therefore, there are some who have written that now the custom is that one's enemy goes to visit, for this brings about peace between them. Right? Like what Elisheva was referring to. Can you just find some way of being there but not being there? Of whether it be a call or calling a neutral third party. Is there somebody, and this is a very critical part of how to de-escalate any conflict, is there somebody who we're both in touch with who can translate my intention in a way that they won't understand it to be something that is patronizing or that's degrading or that's going to be, or they just don't want to see you anyway? Without that, the greatest act of kindness can be misinterpreted and can actually be counterproductive. And then actually, we're not going to read it. I'll refer you to two important quotes on the next page by scholars of conflict resolution, where they talk about some of your checklist to think about whether you should go or not go, whether you should do an act of kindness or not in trying to build a relationship. You know, on the one hand, it should be an act of that's not expected, that might have some degree of risk to show sincerity, right? But on the other hand, you have to make sure that it's not going to be a sign of, he writes, that it won't be interpreted as a gesture or as a ruse. I'm in the source number 7, right? Or maybe as a sign of weakness, or dismiss it as meaningless. And therefore, he recommends that a neutral third party could be quite useful in overseeing the exchange of gestures to make sure that it's actually translated that way. I'll just invite in one last rabbi who gets kind of the final word, source number 6, to go back. Here we're in Algeria in the 18th century, where he writes, Rabbi Yehuda Aish. He says, it is worthy for an enemy to go visit his enemy. For if the visitor was insulted, through the visit there will be peace between them, and it is possible that the sick person will ask forgiveness from him, for he sees that even though he, the visitor, was insulted, he lowered himself to come visit and ask mercy for him. And even if the sick person was the one insulted, nevertheless the visit will be like asking forgiveness, and in general it will lead to bringing peace, and one mitzvah leads to another. Here he raises two different possibilities in terms of who kind of insulted the other one, who perceives himself as the victim. That if I am visiting somebody who insulted me, I'm giving them a certain gift, a unilateral act of kindness, and creating a space, an opportunity that they can heal in their relationship in this time of vulnerability. Or if I am the one who insulted them, by doing this act, it's a symbolic act of forgiveness. It's a symbolic way of normalizing that relationship.
I add something to this last comment. From experience, it's very important that you set you when somebody is near death.
Mm.
Because very often they don't allow themselves to die because of that tolerance. So it's gesture.
Yeah. Right. Thank you. I think we could. I would add onto that, which is that sometimes by not going, it's like they didn't even come to the Shiva. You know, or they didn't even come when he was dying. Like, it's not only that you're not doing a good thing, it actually can be a sign of, wow, that is how far we have come in our break, in our relationship. I just want to bring, we weren't going to go too political in terms of international relations, but I wanted nevertheless to say, you know, we're talking about interpersonal within a family, within a community, but I still wanted to end with a few examples of how complex this is on the international or intergroup conflict. If you turn to the last page, I brought just a few pictures of examples that I think would be contemporary examples of what does it mean to reach out to some group, nation, in a time of need, and how complicated it is. The first, top left-hand corner, I think over 10 years ago, there was a terrible earthquake in Iran. And there was a whole bunch of Israeli groups, not official government, that wanted to raise money and food to give to the Iranian people. And the news in Israel was the Iranians rejected it. They didn't want to receive it, which was perplexing. Why would they not want to receive it? But I think when we look at how complicated these things are, right, we have to ask, what would it symbolize to the Iranians to say that they got a gift from Israelis? Their acknowledgement? Why else might they not want to accept it? It's saying, oh my God, I need you? Seriously, you think I've fallen to that place that I'm going to, right? It creates, what else? It shifts the power dynamic, right? It could easily be seen as, now I am the strong one, I'm coming to help. But I'm sure the Israeli citizens who were doing this had the most incredible intentions, that they really wanted to help. It's possible that they did want to break down the enemy system, that you interpret us as just all evil. It's possible that the Iranians at that moment of weakness were not interested in recalculating, are they enemies, are they not enemies? They don't want to be thinking in those terms, right? Because what happens when they walk in to that helping the donkey and then go into the inn together and start talking is that it shifts, it creates cognitive dissonance, and all of a sudden I have to shift, wait a minute, I thought this guy was all bad. Now it's like, I don't know what to do with that. I'm curious, and it creates a space, but I don't necessarily want to always go through that. The other example that it's interesting now how this story continues to unfold is the Turkish Turkey-Israeli relationship. That several years, let's see, how many years ago? I think it was about a year after the Marmara, where Israel and Turkey kind of cut off relations, was the terrible Carmel Forest fire. And Turkey was the first that sent the planes to Israel. And there was a whole bunch of discussion of, huh, could this be an act of kindness that will then allow them to go into the inn, the two donkey owners, and start to actually engage in dialogue? It's not in place of negotiation. It's a prerequisite that it can allow it. Hard to say if that 5 years later it enabled that. Others would say, actually, the Turks were doing it because 10 years earlier, they had a terrible earthquake, and Israel really helped them, and they felt they needed to kind of pay that back. But again, it was a whole question, did that help or not? Another example that comes to mind is Israel's medical assistance to Syrian refugees. Now, here it's a delicate debate, because, you know, they're helping people that are coming over the Golan Heights, but something about the picture, for me, is problematic, or could be interpreted as problematic from the other side. Because when you're doing medical emergency help to people that are in war or whatever it is, and you don't advertise it to anybody, I know that your intentions are purely lishma. But as soon as it becomes the front cover of the newspapers, look at what we're doing to help, it runs the risk of being interpreted once again as what we call in Hebrew the samach le'id, the problematics of, are you trying to gain some kind of, you know, other interests that are interfering with what's happening? So it creates a complicated situation. I'll end with two other ones very quickly. We'll skip the one about Abu Mazen for a moment. When the terrible tragedy happened of the three kidnapped boys, sitting Shiva was an interesting moment that during that whole crazy couple of weeks, and then the subsequent murder of Muhammad Abu Khadir, there was a lot of very interesting Shiva calls that happened during that time. Some of them incredibly effective, some of them actually counterproductive. The effective ones were that there were times where apparently the families had met, or there were Palestinians that showed up at the homes of the family members, of the mothers, of the family. There also were attempts of showing up at the Shiva of Muhammad Abu Khadir. And I've heard, I didn't see this reported on, but I heard that there was certain moments where it was unclear what to do. There was a bus of rabbis coming, where half of them were coming from what the Palestinians would say are settler rabbis. And it created a whole question. Do I want to let them into my tent? Am I normalizing? Is this creating a whole headache that I don't want to be dealing with right now as I mourn for my child? Right? But the rabbis, their intention was, we just want to be able to show that we, you know, denounce that violence, and we want to show our love. But that moment of, do they let the bus in or not let the bus in, I think the bus was stuck for like 5 hours. So it's a very delicate situation of when to engage, when not to engage. What are my interests? What are the needs of the other side? Is there a way that I can ensure that the message will be interpreted in the correct way? So we can't resolve all these things from the text. But the text speak towards values. The text speak towards the highest values that they want to encourage us to think about. And it's really up to us to use, as the Shach said, our common sense of, is this the right one or not the right way to do it? But the encouragement of trying to be a gibor should be giborim, the hero amongst heroes, of saying that that is the person who turns an enemy into a friend instead of somebody who conquers their enemy, destroys their enemy, I think is a profound statement. And I appreciate you all coming out tonight to explore a little bit about how complex it is, but the encouragement to try to engage and do so. Thank you very much. We take a few minutes for questions. We'll take, if your people are interested, we can take a few questions, just 5 minutes, and then we'll let everyone, questions. Yeah.
What's interesting to my mind, I What is interesting to me in all of these cases is we're dealing with a gesture, you know, an action, and then an interpretation, a context. I'm wondering, as you think about this, I mean, think of all the variables that go into how something will be interpreted. I think it's always interesting that the very first thing, which is the gesture, is wide open for so many different interpretations. And how can we assure that it's the right one?
Yeah. Again, I don't think we have an answer for that. I mean,
well, the answer is we can't.
It's
this is human relationships we're talking about.
Right.
No, exactly.
But how do you maximize the possibility that something talks about?
There's a beautiful quote that we didn't read by Mark Gopin, who's really one of the ultimate scholars of this, where he talks about what kind of training it takes to become an expert to make sure that you're going to help people do this in the right way. And it's
really what it comes down to is face to face. It's that encounter and what can happen from that face to face encounter. That's so important. Everything else is abstractions.
Well, but for some people in certain cultures, showing up face to face is the exact opposite thing that you want to do. You have to proceed with caution. Correct? Proceed with caution. Other hands.
How did you know? What I wanted to say is that. Thank you. What I wanted to say is, on the one hand, I'm very surprised that Judaism doesn't just say, you must, actually the biblical text says, you must do this. Because why give people the chance for them to decide for themselves? They should just, Judaism is all about action and not less, much, much less emphasizes intention, I think. That's my interpretation. But when I go to a Shiva house, I feel bad saying, Hamakomi nechem etchem. Because it makes it feel like I'm just doing something because it's a mitzvah and not because I really care about the person. And so I think if Judaism says, no, you must always visit the sick of your enemy, then it wouldn't mean as much if you go and visit the sick because, oh, he's just doing something that he has to do rather than doing it from the right place. So I answer my own question by saying that maybe there's more wisdom in it than just forcing us to do something. By the way, the lo tisna techicha bevevecha, right after that comes the tochacha. So that's Judaism trying to say, and how do you not hate somebody? Because you must do the action. There's a tension.
I just want to say, I'm so glad in every group, in every literate Jewish group, there's someone who says Judaism is all about behavior and all about action. And there's very good reason to say that. And that's not always the case, and it is certainly accurate that our tradition. Well, and I'm going to qualify it more. And if you go back over the materials, even that we just did tonight, there's a lot of stuff that's about action. There's a lot of stuff that's about the work of the heart. So I just wanted to raise in the material that we did tonight. Set aside your hatred, right? And I just can't resist saying, for me, it comes back to prayer. When I say Hamakom Yenachem Etchem, thanks. May God bring you comfort. That's a prayer. I don't have the power. My presence, absent irreconcilable conflict and such a sense of betrayal that my presence is a source of pain. My presence can offer comfort, but then to say Hamakom Yenachem is to pray for divine intervention. And so again, how do we, even in interpersonal situations, for me, there's a question about how do we make our prayer for peace that is part of our daily liturgy and our daily practices as Jews, how do we make our prayer for peace real in our relationships?
Referring to the last part of the conversation and talking about visiting the sick of your enemy, it seemed as if it was very, and I know that we were sort of combining the scope of the conversation to people sort of within your community or interpersonal relationships. And it really kind of frames it even better in the text when it says, you know, if the person is amongst those you are forbidden to hate. So my question is, to what extent does this apply beyond that scope and beyond the interpersonal and the community and really once you get into a group that is truly the other, to what extent do these texts apply to reaching out your hand for peace?
I'm going to let you do
that. Well, it's a great, that's the key ambiguity. All religions, all cultures have their traditions, have their mitzvot that encourage pro-social behavior. But then there's always this kind of scope. And then those, you know, there's the in-group, out-group. And one of the major challenges of integrating tradition with contemporary conflict resolution is how do you expand that? Where are the limits? Are there ways of expanding that scope? You know, it's interesting. Amy was talking about who's the enemy, right? So we talked about a machloket, a difference of opinion within the mechilta. Is the enemy a Jew who left the tradition? Is it the person who just hit your child and it was a temporary hatred? One of the opinions is that it's a non-Jew and idol worshiper. What that's actually saying is that your natural inclination might be that person is the ultimate other. But the context is that ultimate other you have to go and reach out to. Meaning the purpose of them saying it's a non-Jew is actually universalizing the commandment to reach out. But it's a much longer conversation that we go into deep, that you can look at all the different mitzvot and find some who are willing to push the boundaries and say, you know, let's apply this also to the ultimate other, to non-Jews. I mentioned Haman as an example. That's pretty radical. Thank you. I almost was off guard. That's pretty radical. But there were certain rabbis over the last 300 years that try to argue about these mitzvot and other mitzvot, that all interpersonal mitzvot are Jew, non-Jew alike. And they really expand it. A beautiful book that I recommend called Sefer HaBrit HaShalem, the book of the ultimate complete covenant, went through over 300 pages to prove every single mitzvah is Jew, non-Jew, or equal. And that the achicha, the brother, and he goes through and he brings tons of sources. Right? So it's you know, but then you could have others who are going to say, no, this is only within my exact community of people that are exactly like me, and everybody else is outside. And that's part of the ambiguity. You know, how do we expand it? So I think we're going to pause here. And again, I want to thank everyone very much. And again, mention that there will be another lecture coming up next week and more to come over the summer. And have a good night. Toda rabba.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.